My name is Jessica Yates with the International Security Program here at CSIS. Today is the 28th of January, 2008, and I will be interviewing Mr. Franklin Miller, former Senior Director for Defense Policy and Arms Control at the NSC. This is part of a series of interviews for the oral history component to the PONY project, evaluating U.S.-UK nuclear relationship in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the 1958 Mutual Defense Agreement. Almost everyone we've interviewed has dropped your name as someone who would know more about a various question that we asked that they couldn't sufficiently answer. You were knighted on behalf of your contribution to the U.S.-UK special relationship. So your career sort of embodied, I think, the core concept of this project. So I'd kind of like to skip over the frivolous intro questions, but at the same time, for the purpose of the interview, or for the abstract, could you sort of briefly describe, if it's possible to describe it briefly, your career in interaction with the official capacity you had in which you interacted most with the MDA?
Okay. Well, it wasn't as such the MDA, which generally refers to the nuclear weapons aspect as much as it was to U.S.-UK cooperation in the field of nuclear weapons policy. And it spans the period of December 1981 up through, I guess, when I left government service in March of 2005. So it's about a 24-year period. Is that right? Yeah, I guess. 24-year period. Which started out quite narrowly focused on the UK's acquisition of the Trident II missile, and then broadened in a number of very different ways. And most of my time was spent at the Pentagon. I was a Pentagon official from August 79 until January 2001, and so the interactions took place in that context, and I can describe each piece in detail as you wish.
Okay. How important do you think the 1958 agreement is to the overall nuclear relationship between the U.S. and the U.K., or even the overall relationship? I think some of the interviewees have trouble kind of tracing back cooperation to the 58 agreement itself because it's so bound up in a broader special relationship that's, you know, constitutes and reflects the relationship. So I guess one way of thinking about this is, what would the world look like, or what would the relationship look like, had the MDA never been signed, but World War II had happened and the Manhattan Project had happened, but there was no mutual defense agreement?
I think without, again, you'll have to get lawyers to tell you the actual facts of the matter, but it would be my inclination that without the 58 agreement, without the ability to talk to the United Kingdom about nuclear warheads, nuclear warhead design, the whole category of restricted and formally restricted data, there would be no legal basis for us to cooperate with the United Kingdom on their own strategic deterrent system. And as a result, without an underlying legal basis, it would have been extremely difficult to proceed ahead with the Polaris Sales Agreement of 62. And the Polaris Sales Agreement was actually the umbrella agreement under which I did much of my work, because I did not deal with the warhead side specifically. Others like Linton Brooks dealt with the warhead side. I was involved in helping to get the 58 agreement extended. I guess it has to be extended at 10-year intervals, and so I played a role in that. Once in the Clinton years, so that would have been 68, 78, 88, 98. And then for some reason there was something that occurred in the first 4 years of the Bush administration. I can't...
At 2004, it was extended for 10 years.
Okay. So it was both that one and the previous one, I played a significant role in just, you know, pushing the bureaucracy to get the pieces of paper signed. It's just red tape, bureaucracy, and there is, and again, you'll know about more than I, but I recall vaguely that there is a requirement that it needed to sit on the Hill for a certain number of days while Congress was in session for the extension to take place, and if we got it up late, then it would not have been extended and indeed ran the risk of actually expiring. And so it was a question of just pushing the bureaucracy to just get the I's dotted and the T's crossed and just get it up there. But there was a risk that, right, that it could have expired just by accident.
I guess I'll clarify. My question is, had we not cooperated in nuclear affairs. So the MDA is the basis for the legal basis for technical cooperation. Had we not had that cooperation after the Manhattan Project,
right.
Do you think that the UK would have acquired their own independent deterrent, or how would?
Oh, sure. I mean, the UK was developing its own nuclear weapons, and I suspect the UK was a nuclear power as of, the early 50s. So the UK had their own designs. So there would have been a UK deterrent of some kind or another. And absent the 58 agreement, they perhaps would have gone in different ways from the submarine-based deterrent that they have. But each side would have been the poorer, I think, in terms of not having the kind of technical interaction and cross-fertilization that occurs from separate communities that are working on similar kinds of issues. And one of my broader themes is that while the independent deterrent is of great importance to the United Kingdom, it was also of great importance and remains of great importance to the United States that we had a partner nuclear power in the NATO alliance and in the Western world, so that we did not have to bear sole burden.
But the technical cooperation itself, does that change the strategic nature of the UK, the UK's, or just the UK and the US deterrence? The fact that had we not had this technical cooperation, but they had developed their deterrent, does that technical cooperation and the similarity, closeness in terms of the design of the weapons have a significance strategically?
You'll have to talk to the people who do the work on the warheads. I mean, I don't know but that the British did not help us discover flaws in our designs or vice versa over the course of the technical interaction. But I was never close enough to that part of the work to know the answer to that question.
That you just kind of described is just the benefit of having the cross-fertilization and the benefit of having a partner that thinks. What do you think it is that the United States gained from this interaction? I know that you weren't expressly involved in the weapons design, but kind of seeing the broader picture, do you think it's just having someone, clearly they didn't have the codes and as extensive of computers as we do, but is it just having someone that thinks differently?
Absolutely. You know, you go at the problem somewhat differently and helps you understand when you get stuck, what it means, why you got stuck, a different way of approaching the problem. And then, as I say, there's this broader element that we can talk about later, I presume, about the broader element of the relationship. But again, you need to talk to somebody who is deeply involved in the warhead side of the work.
But even in broad terms, John Harvey, I interviewed about a week ago, and he kind of described this paradox where the benefit to cooperating bilaterally is, or at least in this context, is having someone that thinks differently, just having a different perspective, even if it's not necessarily more advanced. However, because of that, you want to expand cooperation. The paradox is that you expand cooperation, then you lose the thing that makes that cooperation beneficial. Is that something you see, or is that a paradox that needs to be resolved or thought about?
It's something you always think about, but there are ways to make. I mean, we come from two different backgrounds and two different cultures in many senses, and if you talk to people in the nuclear weapons community, they will tell you that Los Alamos and Livermore approach problems differently. So if we can maintain the cooperation that occurs between the two U.S. laboratories and still have Los Alamos and Livermore have different design philosophies, we can do it with the U.K. I mean, that's not something that would have kept me up at night. And indeed, I mean, there were times as we began way back in the late 90s when we started talking about the W-76 life extension and the work that needed to be done to think about a W-76 follow-on, I made absolutely certain that the British play in that because of the different perspective that they could bring to that enterprise.
Speaking of that, will the British be involved with, if any of these modernization initiatives go through, what sort of role will British scientists have to those, or even diplomats have in those implementing modern, in the ROW?
I believe there are discussions ongoing now, but I'm not current on that.
Okay.
I believe and hope that we in the British, that AWE is talking to to the nuclear weapons community here.
Does our British counterparts, they have a stake in the future of modernization?
They will need a reliable replacement warhead of their own. In fact, they're working on one. It's got a different name. It's got another acronym. But they are working on the same kind of a thing for their W-76 variant.
Well, does the extent of cooperation that is sanctioned in the status quo by the MDA cover that, or will it have to be expanded in order to enable cooperation?
My understanding is that it's covered.
It's covered already.
Again, I'm not the expert on the nuclear weapons cooperation, but my understanding all along has been that there is no need for an amendment to the MDA. I think I would have heard had there been a requirement for an amendment to the MDA. Well, the question is, expansion of the work under the agreement or an expansion of the agreement. I mean, expanding the agreement actually carries with it, you know, the need to go up and amend statute. And so maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you could just amend the agreement. Yeah, I suspect you could just amend the agreement. I'm wrong. Not statute. But still, you'd have to write some things down and have them ratified by both countries.
Okay. Speaking about the sort of expansion or the scope of cooperation itself, have you witnessed it, or I believe that the scope of cooperation has expanded during your time in government. What are the concerns? I guess there's the obvious national security concern. How viable is that? How much of a threat do you think is posed by sharing information in nuclear weapons design?
I didn't see any threats. Again, I mean,
why do the boundaries exist?
There's an Atomic Energy Act. That's why. I mean, there are. I'm not qualified to answer these questions. Okay. You need to talk to Harvey and Brooks and the rest of the people who dealt with the technical side. I mean, there are clearly, if we have made some scientific breakthroughs in certain areas that we believe only we should know about, then exposing it outside of any circle is going to risk that the information gets lost. There is, you know, in the deep recesses of some people's minds, there the memory of the fact that Klaus Fuchs was one of the people who leaked the original A-bomb design to the Soviets, although there were clearly Americans involved in that spying as well. But by and large, I think that the cooperation is such that it continues that whatever risks are inherent in it, the benefits are greater. And to the degree that there are limits on the actual cooperation in the warhead area, my understanding, which someone will validate, is that those are based in the 58 agreement. I'm sorry, the Atomic Energy Act.
Speaking of that, and I think that you can speak to this with much more authority, I guess, but what explains this level of trust? I mean, it's the level of cooperation on nuclear weapon design, there's few more closely held secrets in the world, and you know that we can share with the British, despite Clausewitz and the espionage incident. What do you think explains the ability for us to cooperate?
Well, I mean, you start out from the premise that the United States and the United Kingdom are allies of long standing with common purpose, whose national security is deeply intertwined, and that it is of enormous importance to us to carry out our mutual role of preserving democracy for ourselves and for the Western Alliance, that we cooperate. And the warhead area is one of many areas where we cooperate, where the public may not necessarily be fully focused, but there's a tremendous amount of intelligence cooperation. There's a tremendous amount of military planning. There's a tremendous amount of cooperation among the operational forces. For example, there are a few elements of our forces that operate as secretly and covertly as the submarine force, and yet the submarine force and the Royal Navy submarine force interact hand in glove all the time. So the nuclear weapons area is one of a number of areas where we work together, because the benefits to both countries and to the NATO alliance are extremely significant, and both sides get more out of it than if they were doing it alone.
Do you think that the purview of the MDA is limited to technical exchanges, obviously, but and your involvement is much more with the operational
and policy
side. Do you think that the technical relationships that were nurtured, or the relations that were nurtured through the technical exchanges, or just the relationship itself, carried over to help resolve operational issues?
No.
Totally separate spheres.
It turned out to be that way. I mean, much of what I did was in building a relationship in the policy and operational realms that did not exist, even though by the time I got involved, cooperation under the 58 agreement had been going on for what, 33 years, right? 23 years, if I get involved in 81. There were huge gaps in the relationship that had not, in fact, been closed and that needed to be closed, and therefore I went out and closed them.
Would you like to comment more on those gaps and those kind of hurdles that you had?
I mean, do you want me to go into the whole story? Because the story is that in December 1981, the U.S. and the U.K. cooperated in the 58 agreement sense, Joe Woggs and all of those kinds of working groups. And they cooperated in the strict SLBM technical area under the Polaris Sales Agreement. But there was little to no policy discussion of U.S. and U.K. nuclear policy, and there was very little operation involvement. In the policy area, the discussions were generally limited to discussions of NATO nuclear policy, sort of this third entity out there, in the context of NATO ministerial meetings. And in the operational area, I can't think of any, you could say that at the nuclear targeting cell in SHAPE headquarters, there was a meshing of U.S. and U.K. forces in the SHAPE war plan, the SACUR war plan. But there was no independent discussion of the U.K. and U.S. independent deterrence. There was no dialogue whatsoever. And when I got involved at first, it was in the negotiations whereby the U.K. came to us and said, you're going ahead with the Trident II missile. We agreed with President Carter to buy the Trident I missile. We, as you know, do not ever want to operate an SLBM system which is unique, and so we need to buy the Trident II. And so we got into these negotiations as to how we would sell them the Trident II and in what configuration they wanted the Trident II. And that kind of started the involvement. And then there are any number of different strands which emerge from that in the policy sense to bring things together. Do you want me to just keep rolling?
Yeah.
Okay. There are really two elements. One is having bought the Trident II, the U.K., in the next several years, ran up against the START initiative. When the U.K. came in and talked to us about the Trident II, we talked about selling them a missile system that could carry up to 12 warheads. As START progressed in discussions with the Soviets, the United States decided that the Trident II would carry only 10 warheads, although it was once tested with 12. And once and only once tested with 12. The British had contracted to buy a missile with 12 positions because that fit their deterrent requirements. And so one of the things that we had to do was have a battle inside the U.S. government as to whether the Trident II, which went to the U.K., would be restricted in the number of warheads it could carry. And that was the whole question of the independent nature of the deterrent. And that led to the question as to why did the British believe they needed 12 warheads anyway, which while an independent decision, not subject to U.S. questioning or review, nevertheless opened up a dialogue as to what was their intent. by the mid-'80s, I was director at the time of the Strategic Forces Office in OSD policy, and I did everything except oversee nuclear targeting, and by 1985 I was now overseeing nuclear targeting. And I began to wonder about all of this and began to explore with British officers how we could establish a dialogue wherein each side could talk about its deterrent philosophy and its deterrent plans without in any way compromising the independent nature of the PSYOP or the British National Plan. We had never had discussions as of 1985 between the U.S. and the U.K. and what the National Plan did and what the PSYOP did. And so I established with the British colleagues, having gotten approval from Secretary Weinberger to carry out those discussions, a dialogue which was embodied in twice yearly nuclear policy staff talks, which continue to this day. And all topics were on the table. That led to all sorts of useful interchanges because we were able to understand that as the UK was moving from the Polaris system, which was just two warheads which were not independently targeted, to a system that carried 12 independently targeted warheads, there was a whole process of culture and learning that they needed to understand to handle this much more capable and complicated targeting scheme. So this, as I said, led to a whole series of discussions. It led to actually technical discussions. For example, as we were going through the debate about the so-called nuclear winter and why American damage calculations only took blast into effect and not fire, it turned out that the British had a fairly sophisticated view of the effects of fire. And so we established a technical dialogue about fire and fire effects and all of that. So again, once you get a dialogue going and you get people comfortable with the fact that they can talk, the space just keeps expanding.
Can I ask about this dialogue? How did it evolve? Did their conception of the role of nuclear weapons impact our, doctrinal issues?
I don't know that either impacted the other in a way that you could sit up one day and say, wow, that made a big difference. But through constant conversation and communication, undoubtedly the ideas of one side affected the thinking of the other and vice versa. And I suspect that as the UK talked to us about how we handled highly MIRVed systems, they began to get various different views of their own use of the system, which eventuated in whatever doctrinal approach they took. Now, a second thing that we did was, again, to find ways to help the United Kingdom save a little bit of money here and there, but also to assist them to work more closely with us. And so, for example, when faced with the cost of building an even larger storage facility at Coalport, at the Royal Naval Ammunition Depot at Coalport, which was opposite the Firth from the place where the submarines are based at Faz Lane, we came up with this idea where the UK would not actually buy missiles by tail number, but would buy drawing rights on a set number of missiles. And so all spare missiles for the Trident II force on the East Coast are stored at King's Bay. And so a British submarine, when it is ready to enter operational service, comes to King's Bay, draws its missiles, goes home to Coalport, loads its warheads, and lives out its operational patrol cycle. When it's ready to go back into overhaul, it offloads its warheads at Coalport, goes to King's Bay, offloads the missiles at King's Bay, and then comes home and goes into the shipyard. So there was no need to build this extensive missile storage facility up at Coalport. It made a whole lot of sense. And, there are ways to have to parse through all of that with START, but we did that. When it got to the point of thinking, okay, how do the Brits really get involved in learning how to handle the Trident II footprinting model, which they had bought, and how do you work the interactions of targeting up to 16 missiles, which could carry up to 12 warheads. We decided that one of the ways to do that was to establish the post of a UK liaison officer at US Strategic Command, at the time SAC and Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff in Omaha. And so you'll find that in the mid-80s, as the SHAPE targeting center in SHAPE headquarters drew down because of manpower constraints from the other allies, it stood up again in a new form out in Omaha with the UK liaison officer, who also, because he was being integrated with the folks at Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff who were doing all of our nuclear planning, began to understand the vagaries and the routines of multiple warhead targeting. So by the late 80s, we now had a three-legged stool where there'd been a one-legged stool, where there'd been the stool of technical cooperation. We now had a policy leg and an operational leg to go along with the technical leg under the Polaris Sales Agreement. And then if you want, I mean, there's then under the MDA as well. So we handled all of those things, and the relationship just grew. And the nuclear staff talks, which originally had been two people from my team and me and three people from the UK, you know, grew and grew, and we had joint staff people. No, we always had something from the joint staff. We had people from the Trident Project office and from their British counterpart, and people from Omaha and from the British Planning Command. So we had more and more people involved in the nuclear dialogue, and they didn't have to talk to each other only when the group met twice a year. They had each other's phone numbers. And then we got into even further things, talking about hypotheticals and exercises and a variety of nuclear communications, helping the Brits out at one point when they needed to lease some frequency ranges on some of our naval communication stations because they had to take some of theirs down for repair. So I mean there were all manner of things that went on under this relationship.
Did you use those numbers frequently? You know, you said you had. Would you encounter a difficult problem, you know, policy wise or operational wise, and call a British counterpart?
Absolutely. I probably talked to my British counterpart starting in the mid 80s at least every 2 weeks, whether I had to or not. And I encourage my team to do the same thing. You know, to have conversations, to get together. You know, if you were flying there for other reasons, drop in on your counterpart, and the same thing in reverse. So absolutely all the time. And you know, one of the byproducts is a series of fast personal friendships that developed over the time.
How important were those personal friendships, the personalities, and I mean that kind of stuff make a difference?
Absolutely. It makes a tremendous amount of difference, because if you get to rough spots, and there were some times when we had some bumps. I mean, people kind of just understand, okay, this didn't work. Let's figure out why it didn't work and go back. But I mean, there is a shared commitment to each other and to the common cause of the alliance that allows you to get past hard times, and that establishes a bond of trust that allows you to say, well, you know, we haven't ever talked about this before, but perhaps we should expand that a bit. And, you know, you kind of check with whoever you need to check with, and you go on and do it, expanding the circle.
Sure, or just calling the expansion circle.
Well, I don't know. At one point, the Polaris, the British Polaris successor had a, not successor, the British Polaris system had a very sophisticated exo-atmospheric penetration aid system. By the mid-80s, as the U.S. was focusing on SDI and the question of dealing with countermeasures, we thought, and of course, as the British system was phasing out, the Chevalier Polaris system was phasing out, we thought, well, wouldn't it be useful to demonstrate to the guys at the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization and to the leadership of the Department of Defense what this penetration aid does? And so one time when the British Secretary of State for Defense came on a routine trip to Washington, my counterpart and I had arranged for them to do a video demonstration of what Chevelline looked like, you know, and how the penetration aids deployed in space. You know, that had never been seen by any American before, to my knowledge. So it was that kind of stuff that, you know, you just kind of said, well, you know, we're working on this. You should know more about it.
As this dialogue expanded, did it impact the independence of, you know, in terms of the employment of their...
Absolutely not. In no way, in no manner, in no form. I mean, while we talked about what the British National Plan was and what the PSYOP was, we never really talked specific aim points. So we never knew what they were shooting at as far as a specific location, you know, a specific... unique target, or what's called in the parlance a desired ground zero. So while we exchanged ideas, there was never any discussion which in any way would have given either side some sort of an insight that would have infringed on the independence of their deterrent or of ours. Another area that grew out of the interaction was the statement that was written in, I don't know, 1990 or 1991. Ambassador Brooks will give you chapter, verse, and date, which is part of the START Treaty, in which the United States makes the statement to the Soviets in what's called third-party relations or something like that. But there's a formal statement by the United States as to what our relationship is with the UK, and that it is outside the bounds of the START agreement, and that the UK deterrent is utterly independent, and that what the British put on their missiles is the British business, and that we have a broad, open-ended commitment to support the British system and its modernization in perpetuity. You know, and so basically, we could have sold them any nuclear system under the sun. We were working the Polaris and Trident sales agreement, but I mean, we did work with London this statement, the satisfaction of the most senior levels of both government before we deployed it with the Russians. And so, again, I mean, this is something that occurred because we had to do it, but it was eased by the fact that I worked it with my friends in London at the embassy here. Right. So, you know, again, this is when you have absolute confidence that the person who's sitting next to you at the table is a close friend and someone that you trust completely, there's really no limit in what you can get done.
Some interviewees have described the nature of the cooperation as closer than interagency cooperation.
Absolutely right. In many instances, no question about it.
What were some of the rough spots that you described, like particular problems? Did the United States ever have to make compromises in these issues?
The rough spots really didn't involve the strategic systems at all. I mean, to the degree there were differences in viewpoint, I guess, is the way I'd put it. It had to do with the ways that we were modifying the NATO deterrent in the mid to late 80s and going into the 90s, leading to the Bush 41 so-called presidential nuclear initiative, which drew down and retired a whole bunch of nuclear systems that we had forward deployed in NATO. And in the middle of all of that, sort of in 1990, there was a period of time when we were going to deploy nuclear-capable F-15Es to the United Kingdom with nuclear weapons. We had already two nuclear bases in the UK for F-111s. So there was a negotiation on a third base. All of that, again, was facilitated. The policy options and discussions, I guess the creation of options and discussion of options was all done in the channels that we had established as close friends, you know. And you had to bring in the U.S. Secretary of Defense, was Mr. Cheney, and his British counterpart, who were not that close, you know. And there were issues, but I mean, we always were able to work it up. And you know, sort of post 91, post the nuclear initiatives, as we tried to sit down and say, what should the NATO deterrent posture be in the future? There were differences of view that London and Washington worked out in a series of iterative versions of papers, you know, to the point where we were both happy with the end product. So I wouldn't call them rough spots. I wouldn't call them rough spots at all.
Does this kind of the nature of the bilateral partnership that you witnessed, does it kind of inform your conception of bilateral partnerships broadly writ, or multilateralism, the possibility for, you know, for two democracies with different domestic audiences to work towards, you know, really work towards ends? Or is it, you know, could it happen with another country?
I mean, I suppose theoretically it could happen with another country. The fact of the matter is that it has not happened with another country. And it has not happened with another country probably because the cultural ties are so strong and the operational and technical capabilities on both sides are so strong and the sense of shared mission is so strong that it's difficult. It would be difficult to create all of that unique set of ties with another country. I mean, there are close ties with other countries in other ways, but to say that, you know, the totality of what is called the special relationship would exist with another country, you know, we had plenty of opportunity to do that. Now, we have small r special relationships with other allies and friends, but nothing of the scope that matches what we do and talk about with the UK. I mean, I suppose Australia comes close, but again, there's no shared nuclear deterrent mission. You know, in sort of a related but totally different area, when the UK decided it wanted to buy the Tomahawk cruise missile, it was worked basically through me and my counterparts. You know, it wasn't the nuclear version, but, you know, having established these ties, and because it somehow got into the whole question, you know, tangentially of START, you know, that was worked through me. So again, I mean, these channels, once established, can be broadened and used for any number of different mutual advantages. And again, I mean, in the 90s, because I have all these ties with the Royal Navy, when we were suffering some issues in our submarine force, the Royal Navy submarine force stepped up and was of significant assistance to us in ways that we didn't conceive of and which we needed very badly. So again, quite far afield from the original cooperation on Trident, but nevertheless vital.
I feel like a lot of the explanation for the level of cooperation is the shared objective and shared interests.
Mm-hmm.
If it is true, it's almost that they're that seamless, our interests, what is the function of the UK independent arsenal? Why couldn't they just exist under the US extended deterrent?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, however coincident the national interests of both countries, they are, in the end of the day, two independent countries. From a UK perspective, being a nuclear weapons state gives them a stature and an international standing that they don't have without being a nuclear weapons state. And it allows them, in the event of an absolute worst-case situation, to look after their own interests by themselves. So if you want to posit a situation in which, for some reason or another, Britain gets into some sort of a terrible situation where its national interests are at stake and we're not willing to support them, it's got its own ultimate deterrent. From our standpoint, particularly at times when the anti-nuclear sentiment around the world is higher than normal, it's very helpful to have another country that is NATO's second or first nuclear power, depending on how you look at it, because we don't have to bear the sole burden ourselves. We don't have to bear the burden of thinking about it and talking about it and carrying the public water on it. So it's another way of, you know, different ways of looking at the same issue and coming up with a common theme. And during the Cold War, and this is This is a bit antiquated. One of the reasons for having two centers of decision-making, which was the phrase, two centers of decision-making, was that if the Soviets decided that they were going to attack NATO, they might convince themselves on the basis of some intelligence that Washington or London might not respond. But because the decision-making process in each capital was separate and independent, they could never convince themselves that both Washington and London would never respond. And so that added to deterrence. Why did it never, and it was always called, I mean, you will see in the literature the phrase two centers of decision-making. You know,
does that dynamic still exist, do you think, at all?
Well, it doesn't exist now because there is no direct nuclear weapons state threat to the existence of the United States, the United Kingdom. Should things go bad, and there is a direct nuclear weapons state threat to the United States and United Kingdom, then it would conceivably come back into play. You know, as possible. Now you could say, why doesn't this apply with the French as well? And the fact is that the French deterrent was, as conceived by de Gaulle, you know, completely, totally removed from discussions with anybody else. And indeed, de Gaulle originally described it as being a two azimut, pointed in all directions. You know, everybody knew it wasn't, but you could not have the same kinds of discussions with the French. And whereas the United States, United Kingdom pledged their nuclear forces to the defense of NATO and placed them under the control of NATO command, France never would do that. France would always say, we'll be there for you. But they would never describe at what point the nuclear French, the force de frappe, would actually come in support of NATO, nor would it coordinate its force planning with NATO's force planning. So, you know, thank goodness we never got to those kinds of situations where we had to actually contemplate use. But uncoordinated plans, again, three plans, U.S. national plan, independent U.K. plan, and a coordinated NATO plan, which was separate. You know, there's a fourth plan out there, there's a French plan, which is totally, completely uncoordinated. And, you know, obviously from the standpoint of anybody who's involved in strategic planning and execution, that's a major problem.
The high-level group at NATO,
yep.
What's the composition of that group?
Composition of that group is a staff-level representative. No. The high-level group is chaired by a U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense. Which was me. I mean, I chaired it as an assistant secretary acting and then as a principal deputy assistant secretary, but I chaired it for 4 years. The big thing about the high-level group is that it's got representatives from capitals, senior representatives from capitals. There is what they call an NPG staff group in Brussels, which is usually the colonel or the lieutenant colonel level. A bit of context. After the multinational nuclear force fiasco in the mid-60s, the United States creates what's called the Nuclear Planning Group, which operates at the ministerial level. And that's the U.S. and the U.K. and a selected ally from each of three areas, the north, the central, and the south of NATO. And they get into some fairly technical areas and some sensitive, war planning areas, technical, and sensitive discussions. But it's always a very restricted group, and it operates at the ministerial level twice a year for a day and a half. When NATO goes through the big convulsion of the two-track decision in 79, the NPG gets expanded, and all members of NATO at the ministerial level now sit in the NPG. But at the same time, in 77, the high-level group is formed for the first time at the U.S., led by Assistant Secretary Dave McGifford, to handle the details of preparing for the work necessary for the NPG ministers to make their decisions. Over time, the NPG as an organization declines in importance. And the HLG picks up the work of being the engine that drives NATO nuclear policy. And so it is the HLG that handles NATO nuclear-specific issues.
I'm just kind of interested in how decision-making goes down at the high-level group. The U.S., in terms of the U.S. and the U.K. and the other and the representatives from the other countries, non-nuclear states, what's the influence, the various influence of the U.S. representative and the U.K. representative and kind of everyone else?
The high-level group is, you know, composed of, what is it, 29, 26 separate national representatives. It can be made to work well, or it can be unwieldy. When I chaired it, we only dealt with, I think, 18 members. I think it was, NATO was 16 plus the three new members minus France, so it was 19 essentially. We had some spirited debates at times, because there were times when countries like Canada were under instructions from their foreign minister, who was particularly anti-nuclear, and the German foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, at the same time, was anti-nuclear. But the group always, you know, NATO makes decisions by consensus. So we worked very hard, and we always came to decisions and moved the ball forward. My British counterparts and I, over the course of that time, always worked together a little more closely than we did with the other allies, sort of laying out a game plan as to where we were going from the perspective of NATO's two nuclear powers. And there was never any daylight between me and my British counterpart. We always talked extensively in advance. But by the same token, I never went into one of those meetings without having talked extensively to my Norwegian counterpart, my Dutch counterpart, and my Italian counterpart, my Spanish counterpart, so as to make sure that I wasn't walking into a room where, you know, it was blank slate.
Right.
And so it was all a question of management and leadership.
How do those decisions by consensus actually, it seems so difficult to make. I mean, are the Norwegians just not really,
do they
put up a fight?
People will put up a fight, and there are times when people are under instructions from capitals that, you know, you will not agree to that sentence, or you will take a footnote. And then you try and use, you know, whatever moral suasion you have, and you try and isolate people if they are, in fact, one-off. And you know, they say, well, okay, you know, we're going to have to take this up to ministers. You know, you really want to take this up to minister?
Yeah.
You really want to have this as an issue? And, you know, there are various ways of dealing with it. But say again?
How did you?
I dealt with it successfully, you know, and each individual issue, I can't even remember at this point. But there's a lot of one-on-one diplomacy with your counterparts from every nation. And you have, like anything else, you have to build a shared identity, and you have to build a shared sense of mission and a shared sense of purpose. And you got to convince people that the view of the majority is, in fact, the right view. And then you got to get them to go back home and argue your case, or their case, the common case.
But, I mean, are people willing? Are they, you can reason, you know,
you bet.
Argument?
Absolutely. There were times in the early 80s when I was not, you know, I was not doing theater nuclear work, and I was not doing HLG stuff, when it got very hard, you know. But I was lucky in that I was able to make it all work. You know, there were times when it was very, very difficult. When Hadley was my assistant secretary back in the Bush 41 administration, we were talking about modernizing nuclear artillery in NATO. I mean, we were likely headed for a train wreck until, you know, the wall started crumbling, and President Bush made the decision to cancel the modernization and to draw down the NATO nuclear forces dramatically. You know, had we pushed to modernize the artillery, the tube-launched artillery, if we really said, by God, we've got to do this, it could have been a crisis. Similarly, one of the systems that was being talked about then was something called a short-range attack missile to replace the air-delivered bombs. And that, again, was the nations were not prepared to sign up to that. So one of the questions that you have to address as somebody who's leading this whole enterprise is whether you're going to push this to decision. Is it worth fracturing a consensus to get this new weapon system out there? I mean, but that's a matter of judgment and leadership and dealing with allies, and it's diplomacy.
Were the U.S. and the U.K. usually on board in those?
Yeah.
In those?
There was, with the exception of that one. Issue I described to you earlier about the F-15E basing in Europe, I can't really remember one where we in the UK were not of absolutely one mind eventually.
I'm just still kind of interested in this concept, this how you mediate these conflicts at the HLG. I mean, you convince another state that it's in their interests what's motivating their objection, do you change those motivations?
There can be a policy statement that says there's no good role for nuclear weapons anymore. And so, is that true? I mean, how do you work it? You write papers to explore it. You write papers to elucidate and illuminate the issues. You come up with a series of conclusions out of those papers. You then take the conclusions and you translate them into a note that I would sign to the Secretary General that says this is the report of the high-level group, and then you work the report in capitals. And if English into whatever your native language is doesn't really work that well, you work the nuances. I mean, it's a question of diplomacy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what we're taught to do.
Were there just kind of sustained discussions about the role of nuclear weapons in the
sure,
world?
Sure, absolutely. Sure. No question about it, especially in the mid-90s, with the demise of the Soviet Union. Why does NATO still need a nuclear deterrent? Because it's a dangerous world. There are things that you can't take as certainties, because there's proliferation, because Saddam Hussein was developing nuclear weapons, because Libya was developing nuclear weapons. States on NATO's periphery were developing nuclear weapons. So the alliance needed to have a nuclear deterrent, so that all members of the alliance believed that NATO's umbrella covered them. And that's one of the things that the high-level group does, at least in its heyday, it created this sense of sheer belonging and participation, so that it really was a NATO deterrent. And that's why you had, nuclear weapons deployed in certain countries with foreign aircraft and foreign forces, but you also had, for those countries that did not do it, we're not deployer nations, you had them involved in a policy track.
One question issue I've kind of thought about in some other interviews I've had, where the U.S. and the U.K. do not interest, or at least on the surface, don't converge, the CTBT. The U.K. ratified the CTBT in 1998. That said, we cooperate so closely because of the MDA on nuclear issues. Do you think that maybe part of the reason that they could ratify the CTBT is that if a situation were to occur in which the U.S. had to test them, they could just rely on U.S. testing?
No. They wouldn't do that. I mean, I think by the terms of their own ratification. That's a more complicated issue, and I need to talk to John Harvey before I talk to you more about the CTBT. But it is certainly true that the defense secretaries of the United States, United Kingdom, and France were not in favor of a complete zero-yield CTBT. But the President of the United States made the decision that the United States would only seek a zero-yield CTBT. And the other, without the United States saying that it could go for extraordinarily low yield, was it John Major, wasn't it? Neither Major nor Chirac was prepared to go a different way. And the reason that the UK was able to ratify is because it's got a parliamentary system, not a federal system like ours. Once the party leader, who happens to be prime minister, had made a decision, party discipline was going to hold. It was not the case here.
Richard Wagner described a sort of implicit quid pro quo, where because of the MDA, the kind of tactical net benefit of the MDA accrues to the UK side. But there's in exchange for them supporting United States policy desires in the deterrence, domain, broadly writ. Did you witness that sort of implicit quid pro quo?
No. Rich would be in a better position to talk to you about the balance or imbalance in the technical exchanges. As I've tried to indicate on the policy side, it was always a great comfort to me that I was sharing ideas with the UK and had, ultimately the ability to work out positions where we were mutually supportive, and to examine potential different outlooks in the policy world where we needed to be able to at least understand what the differences were, and if not modify our views to at least understand why we were looking at things differently. So no, I always looked at the Brits as equal partners. I wouldn't make the trade that Rich described to you. Okay. Looks like you've got a lot more.
Oh, I have a ton. I actually didn't really ask many of them because I just got off.
Can we have a second session? I just assume we scheduled. I probably should be moving along.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. I mean, you've been great. I definitely got enough to write up an abstract.
Okay. Why don't you send an abstract and we'll work. We'll look at the abstract and then we'll plan a second session.
You'd like to do a second session?
I mean, if you've got more questions, sure.
Some of the questions were about the science stuff because
can't do that, as you know, right?
And so I'll write it up, and then if your schedule permits it, I'll write you an email about the same question.
Okay, you've got my email?
I do.
Perfect.
Yes.
Okay.
It's been so great.
Thank you.
Cool.